Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. In Turkey, the daily clashes between demonstrators and police has grown into a protest movement. The uprising that defies comparisons started modestly last week in the center of Istanbul. Environmentalists gathered in Taksim Square to protest against the government's plan to pave over a small park. Bulldozers started knocking down trees in Gezi Park over the weekend. And police used tear gas, water cannons, and gunfire with rubber bullets to break up the peaceful demonstration. The violence was captured and shared on social media, and it caused public outrage. Tens of thousands of people flocked to Taksim Square to express their solidarity. The objection to losing a rare park with no public input also expanded into widespread complaints about Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian rule. The protests spread to the capital Ankara and dozens of other cities in Turkey. With us today to talk about the civil unrest in Turkey are a newspaper editor in Istanbul and a program coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. On the line now from Istanbul is Emre Kizilkaya. He's the chief editor of foreign news service Hürriyet. He also writes columns and blog posts on Turkish issues. Emre, welcome to Global Journalist.
Welcome. Hello.
So please bring us up to date. So what's been happening in Taksim Square and Gezi Park and other parts of Turkey today?
Yes, today it's calm. This is the last day that Erdogan is in Africa. Now he will return tonight. So there is a very impatient and a bit concerned waiting from different parties in Turkey because Erdogan just a few hours ago, 2 hours ago, he said that he won't back down. He will keep this project of building this Ottoman military barracks on the grounds of this park that these people try to protect some trees there. So people are there still, not as many people as last night, for instance, because the general trend of these protests are that in the daytime, there aren't too many people because most people are at work or schools, universities. So they started to come back to the square, Taksim Square and Gezi Park after 6 p.m. So we will try to see more people soon, I'm sure. And when Erdogan will land on airport, in the airport, we'll see if there will be some people supporting Erdogan or protesting Erdogan. We will see.
Right. And a coalition group called the Taksim Solidarity Platform has emerged. What changes are the members calling for, and do they have a unified message?
There is a confusion in many people, including the people in Turkey, that this Taksim Solidarity Platform is actually an old platform with lots of senior figures inside who were trying to protect the Taksim heritage since the late 80s. So it's not a new group, but the new ones, the people who started these demonstrations are like 20 or 30-ish ages. So they are not these people. But the government wanted to choose somebody to represent them, and it is the government that picked this Taksim Solidarity Platform. Because the problem is the new movement has no leaders. It is very decentralized, just like in Occupy movements in other parts of the world. So when we make a comparison, I guess just like President Abdullah Gül has recently said, we need to make the comparison with European and American movements, such movements, not with the Arab Spring movement.
So it seems like this protest has parts of all of those protests, Arab Spring, the Greek protests, the Occupy movement. Is it difficult to compare this?
But I don't see many common points with the Arab Spring, because with the Arab Spring, there were unelected leaders, dictators. But in Turkey, we have an elected government, although we criticize it, and although it's getting more and more authoritarian, still it's an elected government, and it still has, according to latest surveys, at least 40%, 50% of the electorate support. So, but with the, I mean, there is also one minority, and this minority is not very small. It's like maybe 40%, 50% of people who are strongly against this very centralist approach of Ankara, and especially Erdogan, because Erdogan, the prime minister, is still feeling like he's still the mayor, the real mayor of Istanbul, and making all the decisions from Ankara about Istanbul, such a huge project of renewing the number one square in Turkey, Taksim Square. And he is saying that we will build this barracks there, and we will make this opera building here, and we will also build a mosque there without asking people. So these are people who are living there, who are protesting now. Mainly, they are putting this tents there and living there. These hardcore people, not hardcore, but let's say the core of the protest, they are residents here, and they are going to their works, and when they come back, they are very close to their houses. And when you wake up one night with the police tear gassing you at 5 a.m., so it's, of course, people are getting even more angry, and their families and then their friends, and then through social media, all the community gets organized, and more people kept coming. I was there last night, and there was a festival atmosphere, because mainly because Erdogan was not here. He was not following the news. He was not making inflammatory statements anymore. So people were happy, and the police was out of the grounds. So it was, everything was good. But also, we shouldn't forget that the Ankara, in other cities, there are still violent, I won't say demonstrations, because it's mostly because of the police brutality, but also there are some small leftist factions which try to provoke the crowds to attack the police, etc. So, and this tension is mainly because of Erdogan, I believe.
And how did, remind us how the Prime Minister Erdogan reacted initially to these protests?
He first said that these are terrorists, for instance. These are hoodlums, bums, he said. He made derogatory comments about these people, who were actually white collars, mainly white collars, young employees, and some, and a lot of students, university students. So they were not hoodlums. But such a behavior makes the other side also like in a fighting, a resistive mode, you know. It's, when you polarize people like this, you get the reaction. Some people say that Erdogan does it like as a strategy. Some people say that as the elections are approaching, Erdogan wants the society to be polarized again, because he always won the elections thanks to such polarization in the past. But that polarization was between secularists and conservatives. But what he is doing now is different, because it is almost whole people. I was there last night. There were people with women with headscarves, a lot of them. So it's not about seculars.
And is the common element that they all feel like they don't have a voice in what is happening in Turkey?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they are also very angry at the media, the mainstream media, which try to hide the reality, try to hide the protest. So when people are facing such injustice, I mean, I guess in Turkey, this pride is very important with people. If they can beat you, they can beat a Turk and insult, okay, but if you offend the pride, it's worse, and you will get a bigger reaction. And I guess this is because of this, because when you go there and ask people, all they say, it's not trees anymore. It's not the small forest there anymore. It's more about Erdogan's attitude. They want to be heard. They want to be taken seriously. They want to be included in the decision-making process, especially about their environments.
Okay. And you've been spending a good deal of time at Taksim Square and Gezi Park. Tell us about your experiences. Were you there when the violence broke out?
Yeah, I was there. The first day, I have been there many times. In the daytime, I'm at the office, but at night, as there is a huge international interest, I try to meet these demands by at least through Twitter and our English language edition. What I see there is a great spirit of solidarity, I can say, because as I said, these are very different kind of people from very different, with very different ideologies. Some of them have no ideologies at all. Some of them is really politicized, but they are helping each other. For instance, like it's like a bit Woodstock or this 68 spirit, you know. People are dreaming, but at the same time, I'm like 40 years ago now, it is more realistic, I can say, because they have very concrete demands. And they have lists as posters hanged around, you can see. So Erdogan should do this, like stopping this construction, this development project. So with this common points, which I guess Occupy movements in the world had no such common points, this one is more likely to be successful. Because with this spirit and with this concrete demands, I guess it can be successful. But I don't think that they can turn into a political movement, like a political party, because it's really diverse ideologically.
Okay. And how do you think that these protests and possible change in the way Erdogan does rules the country will affect international relations? Are there foreign policy implications?
Definitely, it won't force Erdogan, the government, to resign, I'm sure. But symbolically, it's very important because Erdogan should be seeing now that the people, this silent majority or a small minority, I mean, if this is not the majority, if this is not the 51%, this should be like 49%. So this is a very huge crowd. Can do something, and it already with this protest broke the barriers of fear. So if Erdogan sees it, I guess he sees slowly, it can be good for Turkish democracy because we will have elections soon in Turkey, three very difficult and very important elections, local, general, and presidential. And Turkey is making a new constitution now, and this constitution should be inclusive and more liberal. I guess this process will be important, will be positive about this. By making Erdogan, maybe it won't create a checks and balances system structurally, but it will create one in the mindset of Erdogan, I hope. But the latest signs today, he didn't back down even 1 inch. But tomorrow, we don't know what he will do.
Okay. And finally, I want to talk about what's been happening with the journalists. I understand that a photographer, one of your colleagues, was injured in the protests. And I want to...
Yes. My colleague, Selçuk, is from Hürriyet, and we are going to interviews with him. He's a photographer, and when covering the news story, he was shot by a rubber bullet. We believe it was a rubber bullet because of the wounds. And other journalists, like a Reuters journalist, was hit by a tear gas canister. And the problem is the police probably don't intentionally target the journalists. I don't believe that they try to do it because they are journalists, but the fact that they don't really care who is there near the crowd, they just fire. They don't care because there is no scrutiny there. They know that if there is an investigation, they will be nothing will happen to them, so they just fire. Of course, there were other incidents that at some point some protesters tried to attack some journalists, which also made the work of journalists really hard. Some TV crews, the vans of TV crews were burned by some protesters, some radical protesters, because they were angry that these television channels were not broadcasting anything from these protests.
Has the tone of the media changed now? Or are these TV stations that did not initially cover it, are they giving what you would consider fair
it's
treatment?
Better now, I can say it's better now because the protesters forced them to be better. Actually, they are still broadcasting Erdogan's every word from the start to the end. Every word. Still, mm-hmm. there are problems, but. From the protested side, they air more footage from the protest grounds because there were so many protesters went to the headquarters of some television channels and making peaceful demonstrations in front of these buildings. And interestingly, some television, some employees of these televisions participated, joined in this protest too, because they were also angry that they were not showing the truth to their viewers.
Okay. Well, Emre, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I hope you and your colleagues will stay safe as you're covering this continuing protest movement. Good luck to you.
Thank you, David. Thank you for your interest.
You're welcome. Now, before we begin the second segment of our show, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Journalists in Turkey have been caught in the uprising's crossfire. The country's television stations that initially ignored or downplayed the protests were targeted by demonstrators. And reporters who did write about the protests were criticized by the government and occasionally roughed up by police. Nina Ognyanova of the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, monitors Turkey as the program coordinator for Europe and Central Asia. Welcome, Nina.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. Now, we know of two reporters injured by rubber bullets fired into the crowds. What's been happening lately, and have others been injured?
Well, we're receiving reports every day of new clashes between police and protesters. Mm-hmm. As you know, the clashes initially started in Gezi Park at the ground zero of the events, and now have spread to Ankara, to Izmir, and to other urban cities in across Turkey. So what we're seeing is really a movement of discontent against the policies of Erdogan and his government. Mm-hmm. And the authorities are reacting in a very aggressive way. They're trying to suppress coverage. They're trying to aggressively get journalists to get off the scene. There were even threats of shutting down communications and internet, albeit veiled threats, but issued by one of the top government officials just a couple of days ago. So what we see is a really mounting pressure on journalists that already have been embattled in Turkey with direct censorship and, mm-hmm. and self-censorship, with a variety of prosecutions, politically motivated imprisonment, and intimidation. This is really a grim picture that now is getting the attention of the world because of the dramatic events in Istanbul and across the country. But the events over last week have been really the culmination of a sustained policy of pressuring the media into silence and into lack of criticism.
Right. And before we get into the bigger picture, I wanted to talk about some of the examples of attacks on pro-government media outlets. What's happened with them?
Well, journalists have been caught, between overzealous police officers mm-hmm. and protesters who were frustrated by what they saw as inadequate coverage or complete lack of coverage of the opposition protests. And indeed, they had the right to feel frustrated when protesters were gathering right outside the big mainstream media's mm-hmm. Windows. The media were showing documentaries on penguins and on schizophrenia, just as a couple of examples. And so protesters felt like they were betrayed by the media that were supposed to cover what was happening and really what was shaping up to be a big civil protest. And they stormed buildings that were housing pro-government media outlets like Canal 24 mm-hmm. TV and the Daily Star were stoned. Their buildings were stoned. The news vans of television stations that played down or ignored the protest were.
Why did they play it down? Were they concerned about the consequences of critical coverage?
Yes, of course. I mean, for months and years now, the government of Erdogan has been aggressively suppressing critical coverage. And not only has the prime minister lashed out publicly against criticism on the media, but he has had conversations with media owners and media owners themselves because they have businesses other than their media outlets, have felt reluctant to anger the government into withholding government contracts and losing business. So they have chosen, in a way, to abide by these the red lines that were firmly drawn by the government, and have instructed their employees to not touch any sensitive topics that could potentially anger the authorities.
Right. And how have foreign media personnel covering the protests fared?
From what we are monitoring, the international media are not affected or mm-hmm. not as affected by what's happening. The local media are really bearing the brunt of the frustration of both protesters and again, police. Police has been really indiscriminately firing at crowds. So we have reports of both excessive violence, indiscriminate violence, and individual cases of targeted violence against journalists.
Okay. And let's talk about some of the underlying causes of this. Now, for a while there, Turkey was jailing the most journalists in the world. Is that, and then some were let out. What's the current situation with journalists being jailed for basically doing their job?
Well, Turkey continues to be the leading jailer of journalists worldwide, even with the recent individual releases that we've seen, that we've witnessed. The number of jailed journalists went down in the past several months. As of August 1st, when we published our major report on Turkey's press freedom crisis, we had documented 61 journalists behind bars in direct retaliation for their work. Now that number has gone down to 47, but with recent events and with constant reports about detainments, that number may go up in the next days and weeks. What is important here is that the authorities don't seem to have changed their mentality about seeing Turkish journalists as the enemy, as some sort of a nuisance that has to be dealt with. They are not looking at the media as the watchdogs of the powerful against the powerful, and they're seeing the media as someone that they should control. So that mentality has to change for fundamental reforms to be able to take place in Turkey.
And with the potential for even more widespread protests, I suppose that they could continue to even a harder crackdown on journalists.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we just had, again, one of the top government officials, the deputy prime minister, talk about potentially shutting down communications and getting rid of Twitter. And we had the prime minister call social media the biggest menace of society just a couple of days ago. And we are seeing now reports, we're reading reports that just today in Tunisia, the prime minister spoke about the clashes and said that they will not back down. They will go ahead and finish that mall construction mm-hmm. in Gezi Park. Now the prime minister is about to go back to Turkey, I believe, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So it will be crucial to see what the reaction is to that
okay.
and how he is going to react to the mounting protests.
Great. Thank you so much for bringing us up to date on what's been happening in Turkey, and hopefully we'll see some improvement in the treatment of journalists there.
Yes, that is the hope.
We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Turkish journalists Emre Kizilkaya and Nina Ognyanova from the Committee to Protect Journalists. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungankar is our executive producer. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now Free Press Watch, a weekly segment on Global Journalist, where we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Elisa Lopez. Today's news comes from the BBC, The Guardian, Reporters Without Borders, Reuters, and Human Rights Watch. Four Ugandan media outlets resumed service last week in Kampala after government security forces occupied their offices for 10 days. The closure was in response to the leak of a letter from the Ugandan Coordinator of Security Services to the Daily Monitor newspaper. It discussed an alleged plot to assassinate officials opposed to the Ugandan president's plans to hand over power to his son. The police stated that leak was a crime. The Kampala police also sprayed tear gas and struck some journalists that were protesting against the occupation. The National Communication Council has suspended the Readers' Forum of an online independent newspaper in Burundi for 30 days starting Friday, May 31st. Human Rights Watch fears the decision might be an advance of the future of Burundi's media. A new media law was enacted Tuesday. Free speech advocates say that it harms media freedom even more. For instance, it restricts journalists' ability to do investigative reporting and weakens protection for sources. The newspaper Iwacu has decided to suspend not only the forum, but also its whole online platform to show this conformity with the intervention of the NCC. For more information on this and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Elisa Lopez.